an excellent talk from Chris, which, in fact, the extent to which these two talks don't overlap is indicative, because I'm talking about British film, British documentary movement's place in British film culture, and that film culture excluded to a large degree popular cinema going, as I'll be talking about more. So that sort of a story is fresh research, which for a long time perhaps was repressed by the weight of the sort of stuff I'll be talking about. So the documentary film movement is a very familiar theme, and this talk is about how it became familiar, or why it's so familiar. Recently, for example, Scott Anthony, who's here, published an excellent book about the GPO film unit. So it's been a recurrent part of film culture since its inception in the 30s. Schematically speaking, it had a sort of position of dominance in British film culture from the 30s, when it started, until the 60s. But since the 1960s, it became the orthodoxy which had to be attacked. So in an influential essay in 1986, Julian Petley came up with the idea of the lost continent of British cinema, which had been neglected within British film culture because of the dominant realist aesthetic bequeathed by the documentarists. And a lot of British academic film studies has taken the route of reclaiming what had been neglected or repressed, which would include sort of Gainsborough melodrama, Hammer horror and sci-fi, and above all, the work of Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger. Andrew Higson, in the same book, in the same year, in 86, wrote that to claim documentary was Britain's outstanding contribution to cinema, which is a commonplace claim, was deliberately to disregard the appeals of popular cinema and commercial narrative filmmaking. So it would be too clever to say that at this point in the cycle, the only part of British cinema that hasn't been reclaimed from marginalisation is the documentary. That's not true. But I think that its years as a bogeyman have given the wrong impression about what the movement was at the time in the 1930s and 40s. As so often, the idea that it was an hegemonic orthodoxy is partly a construction of those who sought to undo it. It's a bit of a paradox. But in turn, a new orthodoxy about the documentary film movement has been created. So the three questions that I'll be addressing are: for whom were the documentary films intended? To what extent was there a documentary realist orthodoxy? And how far was it propaganda? What were the politics of it? Before I start, well, that's part of it, really, I'll give a brief history of the movement for those unfamiliar. The Empire Marketing Board is where the story begins. It's the government outfit, started in 1926, I think, as essentially to placate the protectionist wing of the Conservative Party. It would encourage trade within the British Empire. And its secretary, Stephen Tallant, hired a young Scotsman, John Grierson, who had sort of coined the word documentary during his time in America, to run the film section of the Empire Marketing Board. And Grierson was a forceful and complex individual. He became a giant within British film culture. A prolific writer, above all, he did direct films, but from a very early age, he was writing an awful lot, propagandizing on his for various causes, including documentary. And one thing to bear in mind about him, I think the most important thing, is what Rachel Lowe said much later. Rachel Lowe said, "Grierson wrote and talked so much himself that one can find quotations for almost any view and views on almost anything." And that's something to bear in mind when we talk about the afterlife of documentary and its reputation as an orthodoxy. So Grierson's first film was called Drifters. It was first shown in 1929, and it was meant to promote the herring trade, or the herring fleet, which I suppose it did. But its first screening, famously, its famous incident, was at the Film Society, an elite sort of exhibition space. It would happen 8 times a year. And many famous intellectuals would go to it. It was shown at the Film Society on the same bill as Battleship Potemkin, which was having its British debut. So it was obvious that Grierson had learned from the Soviet filmmakers. He'd done a version of Battleship Potemkin for the American market. And although there was an obvious political incongruity between the sort of Soviet aesthetic deployed to the ends of the British Empire, for highbrow cinephiles, the documentary movement represented a British answer to the Soviet school of filmmakers. Grierson gathered around him a team of young intellectuals, many of them Cambridge graduates to produce films as a unit. Initially, Drifters did okay, but they had trouble getting their films shown before about 1933. And in that year, they moved from the Empire Marketing Board, which was dissolved, to the General Post Office, the GPO, which was at that point the biggest employer in the country. And they were belatedly, this is 4 years after the coming of sound, they were belatedly equipped with sound gear, and they hired the Brazilian filmmaker Alberto Cavalcanti, who had a great reputation for his films in France, to operate the new sound gear. So from this point on, they had a better time having their films shown in cinemas and elsewhere. And by the late 1930s, off the back of films like Night Mail, which is very famous today, it has a verse by W.H. Auden on it and music by Benjamin Britten, they'd acquired this standing within British film culture that Andrew Hickson and Julian Petley are talking about 50 years later. So this British film culture, which I've been using that phrase without really saying what it is, was in its formative years in the 1930s. You can see it as part of the British cultural establishment in general. The GPO film unit was recruited from the universities. This is how many, a tiny number of people were going to university. It's championed in the serious weeklies and broadsheets. It has a foothold in the British Film Institute, which at that point was a fairly minor organisation, but it became more powerful and influential later after the Second World War. So a curiosity of the debate that I'm talking about is that the films which were marginalised were the most popular films at the box office. So when we say that they were marginalised, we mean within this sort of small but very powerful, in a way, corner of British culture. So I'll play a clip from one of the films just to give an idea of what they are. Most of them have grating voiceover narration. This one doesn't. It's Grierson's second film called Grant and Trawler from 1930, the sound version is from 1934.
There we go.
That'll do it. Next one's much better. But the seed of the critique of the documentary movement was also present in the 1930s. Good one. That's all working, yes. In a passage in his essay, Proletarian Literature, published in 1935, William Empson put in a digression about the documentarists, some of whom he'd known since university. Basil Wright, who directed produced Night Mail, and Humphrey Jennings were friends of his, and the essay first appeared in the Leaders' Journal, Scrutiny, which was published in Cambridge, and F.R. Leavers, Community Leaders, were both also contemporaries. Later, the essay appeared in the collection, Empson's collection, Some Versions of Pastoral, which is where we take our title. So, Empson's essay is about the proletarian novel of the early 1930s, books like Love on the Dole and related themes. And it got introduced into the debate about the documentary movement by Raymond Dergnath or Derniat in the 60s and is used by Hickson and other writers later. So according to William Empson, pastoral was a genre in which simple people expressed strong feelings in learned and fashionable language, implying a beautiful relation between rich and poor. Folk literature is by, for, and about the people. Pastoral literature, though about, is not by or for. And he defines the documentary as pastoral and the Soviet cinema and good proletarian literature as well. He called that covert pastoral. So Empson went on, the Englishman who seems to me nearest to the proletarian artist, of those I know anything about, is Grierson's film producer, about whom he can't have known a lot because he was very much a Scotsman. But Drifters, said Empson, gave very vividly the feeling of actually living on a herring trawler and, by beauty of shapes of water and net and fish and subtleties of timing and so forth, what I should call a pastoral feeling about the dignity of that form of labour. It was very much under Russian influence, but herring fishermen are unlikely to see Drifters. For all its government commercial claim to solid usefulness, it is a highbrow picture. That lasting word shows an involuntary falsity in the thing. Grierson's influence, strong and healthy as it is something skimpy about it. So, this idea, herring fishermen are unlikely to see Drifters, this is generally accepted. The film historian Jeffrey Richards writes that the films were mostly seen in non-theatrical settings reaching a mere 4 million people in 1935, and says categorically that attempts to release the films theatrically were failures. The documentaries have certainly shown at art cinemas, of which there are very few, and film societies, of which there are also very few. And so Andrew Higson says the documentary itself was the voyeuristic gaze of one class looking at another, behind the camera, but also in front of the screen. So I would say that a general point is that this conflation of the popular with the successful tends to ratify the status quo of the film industry. The documentary films had to please Grierson's bosses in Whitehall. They had to be sold to distributors and then to exhibitors. And the audience tastes were at a number of removes from that process. In any case, the GPO films were mostly very short items, which wouldn't be included in sort of the newspaper listings of a cinema programme. You're deciding what to see that evening, it probably wouldn't come into it. They weren't... it's hard to say what constitutes popularity or success in that context. This film is 10 minutes long, so you may see it by accident. You wouldn't know necessarily that you would. Apart from that, we simply don't have that much evidence about the distribution of the GPO films. We get apocryphal things, but I mean, interesting quote from Michael Powell, who was actually received as a kind of quasi-documentarist when his film Edge of the World came out in 1937. Powell said that no showman needs to be told that one breath of the word documentary will empty his theatre quicker than a fire. They all say so, so it must be true. So there's a degree of sarcasm in that, but that was a sort of a general idea around at the time. But I think that Powell was slightly piqued by being compared with the documentarist because he had sort of more spiritual aims in mind. So over the course of the 1930s, the GPO did build up a non-theatrical network of distribution. They would be shown in schools and by sort of civic institutions in general. And Grierson claimed that it reached millions of people, and he had a famous line about there being more seats outside the cinemas than in. But simultaneously, the documentaries were becoming increasingly geared towards cinema exhibition by approximating story films. Cavalcanti took over from Grierson in 1937. He coined the term neorealism in 1938 to describe what he wanted to do, and that year North Sea, another film set in the North Sea, I guess, did well in cinemas, it was reported at the time, but we need harder evidence. There was a lot of debate within the movement at the end of the 30s about whether it was better to concentrate on non-theatrical distribution, but well before that, Grierson wrote that two of the early batches of films that he made, including the Grant and Trawler batch, to do this kind of, to release sort of short films in those years, you needed to do it in batches, and that's partly why the documentary movement didn't prosper that well. They couldn't produce in volume, but they did them in batches of six, and two of these batches in 33 and 34 got into about 1,000 cinemas, which is a quarter of all cinemas, which is pretty good going considering where they're coming from. Evelyn Spice's film Weather Forecast, which led the second batch, opened in the programme at the Empire in Leicester Square at the end of 1934. So herring fishermen could have seen Drifters. Empson is wrong. The question of whether they like them brings us to a slightly different point. And this is to do with realism. According to Andrew Higson, the documentary is limited to a bourgeois audience because it, quote, aspired to the status of high culture, a serious socially responsible and artistically respectable cultural practice, and that within British film culture, style became something which gets in the way of the message of the film within this ambit. Which is true, that they were serious, socially responsible, and artistically respectable. But what Empson says hints at the difficulty of talking about realism or a dominant realist aesthetic. He says that Drifters gives very vividly the feeling of actually living on a herring trawler by beauty of shapes of water and net and fish, by a pastoral feeling about the dignity of that form of labour. Empson had been a film critic while he was at Cambridge. Style produces the impression of reality there, and it produces a kind of meaning. It's not something which gets in the way. And the documentary filmmakers were quite sophisticated when they wrote about what they did. It's hard to deny that there was some realist intent there. But if you look at Humphrey Jennings, he talks about the documentary filmmaker. He writes that they ought to follow T.S. Eliot in his opinion and his view by bringing together the familiar and the unfamiliar as in the Wasteland, as sort of bringing the ancient into the very modern, all of which can be seen as realist, but it's a fairly sophisticated form of it. As it happens, Grierson himself is largely responsible for the idea that he subordinated style to purpose. One of his favourite words was purposed. Or it's not exactly Grierson's fault, but Grierson's editors. If we recall that Rachel Lowe said that he said many things about a lot of things, what people take away from Grierson is generally what was collected after all the complexity of the 1930s was done. So he did claim to have an unaesthetic purpose. In one of the reprinted pieces, he writes that he writes that the Soviet filmmakers were aesthetically vain and they were guilty of bohemian self-indulgence, and that they'd given themselves the airs and ribbons of art. This was practically Stalinist writing in 1935. But then he wrote that the GPO was the only experimental centre in Europe, and it was devoted to the documentary of industrial and social function. And so that essay comes out from the summer of 1935. But to give an example of the complexity of Grierson's position, I will play a clip from a film that he greenlit in the same month. And it's a famous film that's a cheap point, but I'm going to do it anyway. So it's not strong on industrial and social function. And like I say, it's in the same month. It's a cheap shot. But sometimes this is acknowledged about Grierson. That's not an unknown film by any stretch of the imagination. But it never seems to get in the way of the sweeping generalisations about orthodoxies. If there were a documentary realist consensus, Grierson wasn't always within it. Again, in 1933 he writes, "It may be that we shall never have true cinema again till we have recaptured the lost manner and begin where the cabinet of Dr. Caligari left off." This is an odd thing to hear from someone who signed up to documentary realism. He was in no position to make that a reality, but he had to struggle to repress his inner aesthete. So very closely linked to this idea of realism is the idea of the purposive and the social purpose of documentary. And again, things that Grierson said, it's a commonplace of the documentary school that he was a propagandist, because he wrote himself, "I have no great interest in films as such. I look on cinema as a pulpit." You can't really get away from these quotes. So as a result, the documentary movement is criticised for being message-oriented. The style gets in the way. The style is something which sort of interferes. The style is something that gets in the way. And that's an attributed view to the documentary movement. But it's also criticised for its somewhat paternalist message, because we can see that sort of any stylistic elements were persiflage or an aesthetic strategy and so on. It's sort of, the critique sort of has it both ways there. I think it's hard to dispute on one level that the documentarists did have a social purpose. It was a big part of what drove them, but it doesn't really explain how the movement won its preeminence entirely. Partly the idea comes from a view of the 1930s intelligentsia as more deeply politicised than in any previous decade. It's not untrue, but it's just a bit overdone if you look into the reception of these films in detail. So we come back to William Empson again. "The reason an English audience can enjoy Russian propaganda films," says Empson, "is that the propaganda is too remote to be annoying, no matter what the film's author's intentions." I'm sure that some of Empson's contemporaries did not find the propaganda annoying. But Empson was tolerant of propaganda. It wasn't a problem for him, exactly. He writes that good writing is not done unless there are serious forces at work. It's just that he didn't necessarily have to believe in those forces or agree with them himself. And good writing's not permanent unless it works for readers with different opinions from the authors. So within the British context, probably most of the champions of the documentary did share the documentarists' opinions, which were understood not only through their films, but through their writing. Most of them followed Grierson's examples and were prolific writers. But the movement's reputation also comes from abroad, and this is what I'll end on, so I think it's an important point, that most of its admirers abroad didn't really have an interest in the sort of the politics of it so much. So Henri Langlois, who became friends with Cavalcanti through their mutual friend Jean Renoir, he championed their films in France as enabling the continuation and enlargement in London of the research that's begun at the end of the silent era in Moscow, Paris, Holland, Berlin, by Zygmunt Vertov, Georges Lacombe, Jean Vigo, Joris Evans, Walter Ruttmann, researchers everywhere else abandoned since 1933 under the influence of commercialism, academicism, or Nazism. And similarly, Amos Vogel, quite similar figure to Langlois, who died recently. He's the founder of New York Cinema 16, which is a very important screening society for the American avant-garde after the war. He first encountered Night Mail at a film society in Vienna, not long before having to flee the country during the 1938 Anschluss. And so it's not a brilliant quote, but I'll end on it. Vogel says, "Documentary became important to me because of that film. And simultaneously, I realised that this was really a poetic film, and I was amazed that such a boring subject, the workings of the British mail system, could be made interesting."